not only our attorneys, but students who are here with the Courtland Class Program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from around the state are invited to attend an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they are sent the briefs in the case that they will hear, and they engage in a variety of activities related to the case. And as part of the program, the students will meet with a justice of this court at noon after the second oral argument. Everyone's invited to attend that session. The justice will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues involved in the case. If anyone would like a summary of this case, raise your hand and the marshal will give you the summary. All right. Let me introduce the members of the court. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley will meet with the students after this case today. To Justice Bradley's left is Justice David Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm going to introduce the students now. Would the students of the Privets High School please stand? Thank you. We're delighted that you were able to come, and we hope that you have enjoyed and will enjoy your session here and with Justice Bradley. You may be seated. We are also expecting some students from Spotted Eagle High School, but they have not yet arrived. I'll now call our second case for today, 04AP1877, Gary Richards versus First Union Securities, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Gary Richards is James A. Bolt. Mr. Bolt.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is James Bolt, and I represent Gary Richards in this case. This case involves an interesting mix of both procedural and substantive issues. And before I get started with regard to addressing the substantive issues, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the procedural issues in this case. One of the procedural issues that we noted in our brief was the fact that with regard to this motion, the motion that was brought to vacate an existing judgment, that the motion itself, arguing that there was jurisdictional defect in the service of process, itself fails to comply with Section 80201 of the Wisconsin statutes, which require that motions of this nature state the grounds for or the basis for the motion with particularity, and also that these motions make specific reference to the affidavits or supporting affidavits that are filed by the moving party. In this case, we noted at length in our brief that there was the entire motion that was before the circuit court is a one-sentence statement by this particular movement, which said that that in this case there were no managing agents at the Wachovia branch office or the First Union Securities branch office where service was affected. That's all the motion said. I believe it's on page 6 of the motion, which is contained in the appendix of the brief. There was no reference to any affidavit in that particular case, and most specifically, there was no reference to the affidavit of Mr. Ronald McGrath. And for that reason, it's our position that the circuit court obviously had no reason to address this issue, and certainly since the issue had not been raised properly before the circuit court, it should not have been addressed by the Court of Appeals at all. First Union, in response, I went through their brief again this morning. There's no reference at all to 80201, and essentially, from what I can see, fails to address this particular issue.
Now, that's not the reason that the circuit court gave for not addressing the issue, is
no,
it?
No, Your Honor. No, that's not the reason that the circuit court gave.
Does this argument you're making go to the argument made that there are due process implications?
Exactly, Your Honor. And the due process issues, as you allude to, first of all, and the Constitution, as you're aware, requires that reasonable notice be given with regard to the issues that are going to be put before the circuit court. The statute is a bit more detailed, talking about exactly what is required of a motion of this nature, and the need for particularity, and also the need for specific reference with regard to the evidence that is going to be put forward in support of such motion. That wasn't done in this case.
Does your due process argument disappear? Should there be a remand here? Give both sides an opportunity to bring in evidence and argue this?
Well, certainly at that point, there would be, if the court were to remand this issue to the circuit court with instructions to make a finding with respect to the authority or the status of Mr. McGrath, certainly at that point, Mr. Richards would be on notice that that would be an issue that would be addressed by a circuit court, and would have at that point an opportunity to present countervailing evidence in support of his arguments. So, yes, I would, long answer, short question, yes, I would agree with that.
Is that your position, that if you don't get a direct reversal, that should be remanded?
That's our position, Your Honor. That's true. Specifically with regard to the substantive nature of the arguments that were presented to the circuit court and also to the Court of Appeals, this court, you may recall, the court had in its initial notice of acceptance for review of this case had directed both parties to address a couple of different questions. And the first of those questions was, who has the burden of proof with respect to this type of a motion? And I think the answer to that is very clear. I think past Supreme Court decisions have made very clear that when you're dealing with a situation that involves an existing judgment as distinguished from a motion to dismiss a complaint, that a motion to vacate an existing judgment requires that the defendant come forward with specific evidence and credible evidence to prove that, in fact, in this case, that jurisdiction was deficient. It becomes critically important in this case, this issue of who has the burden of proof, because it becomes very clear that there is very, very little evidence in the record with regard to this particular issue. We would argue that there's not much evidence on this point because it's not an issue that was raised before the circuit court. But nevertheless, the defendant has the burden to establish the deficiency of the service of process in this case. That's the West case, that's the Emory case, and that's also the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case. The Court of Appeals starts out its decision by saying that the defendant has the burden of proof in this case. The defendant, or the Court of Appeals also noted in this case that there is, as I said before, very scant evidence. The only evidence with regard to this issue at all is the affidavit of Ronald McGrath. Mr. McGrath's affidavit essentially says two things. Number one, I'm not an officer. Number two, I'm not a managing agent. He also says he's in charge of the Brookfield Wachovia branch office. That's basically all the affidavit says. In response to that, basically what we have said is that, number one, this is not an issue that was raised at the circuit court, and now that it's being raised for the first time at the Court of Appeals, we would like an opportunity to demonstrate that, in fact, Mr. McGrath was an officer of Wachovia. In fact, there was an affidavit that was introduced from the circuit court of Waukesha County in the case of Eberle versus Wachovia Securities that shows exactly that. Mr. McGrath in that case filed an affidavit saying that he was indeed the senior vice president of the Wachovia office. Secondly, with regard to the managing agent, the issue of the managing agent, that's all that was said. Mr. McGrath didn't introduce any evidence. There was no evidence introduced as to what Mr. McGrath's actual responsibilities were. There was no evidence introduced with regard to Mr. McGrath's position within the company, the officers or the directors or the scope of his responsibility. There was absolutely nothing at all. This was an issue that, in fact, wasn't argued by the defense counsel at the circuit court. What was argued to the circuit court was the fact that the person who had actually received the service, Ms. Wisniewski, wasn't, quote, unquote, authorized to receive service. Now, I think that in this particular case, that the case law is very clear on this, specifically with regard to the case of Horgan versus State Farm. There, this Court said that when, as in this case, a process server appears at the corporate offices or corporate branch office of a defendant, identifies himself as a process server, and delivers, asks for somebody to accept service process, he has the right, the process server has the right at that point to expect that the person who comes out and accepts service is indeed authorized to accept service. In other words, what this Court said in the Horgan case is that a process server doesn't have to engage in a game of hide-and-go-seek by possibly being misled by a secretary or a receptionist who goes out pursuant to the process server's request, gets somebody to accept service, and then later have the corporate defendant come back and say, oh no, sorry, that was the wrong person. You got it wrong, we got you. It's not what this Court says is that you've got the right to believe that that is true and to rely on whatever the corporate defendant is going to, whoever the corporate defendant is going to put forth in front of you to accept service process in this case. That's exactly what happened in this case. Take a look at the affidavit of Ms. Wisniewski. There's no statement there that she ever informed the process server that she was not authorized or didn't have the authority to accept service. The only thing contained in her affidavit is a statement to the effect that, well, you know, I never told anybody that I was. I am, in fact, the director of back office operations for Wachovia Securities, but I never told that to anybody, and I don't have authority to accept service of process.
Mr. Volk,
yes,
I understood the trial court's ruling here. The trial court initially ruled against the defendant because of waiver.
Correct.
And cited a one-year time limit.
Yes.
Would you agree that waiver is not the appropriate ruling here?
I would agree that that is not the appropriate ruling. You know, when you're dealing with a situation of an attempt to void or vacate a judgment, while the other grounds laid out in 80607 sub 1 are indeed subject to the one-year time limitation, there is no time limitation with regard to bringing a motion to void a judgment for void because of insufficiency of service or lack of jurisdiction. I would agree with that.
So what you want is you want to go back and have a full hearing on the merits of the default?
Well, I don't think you really even have to get that far, because if you take a look at the Horgan case, once again, what you have here, and you can compare this to the Carroll case, which is the leading case on this issue of who is and how you determine whether one is a managing agent. In the Horgan case, and as well as in the Carroll case, if you look at the very end of it, it talks about, and I'll start with the Carroll case, that in that particular case, you had a person who accepted service on behalf of the corporate defendant coming in and saying, hey, look, you know, I'm not the guy. I run this generating station, if you recall the facts of Carroll. I run this generating station, which produces some power for Wisconsin Electric Power and Light, and that's all I do. I just run my little generating stations. There's 34 of these things around the state. I don't have any authority to hire anybody. I don't think I'm the person that you ought to be serving. That's what this person said. There's nothing like that in this case. Like I said, in this case, what you have is a process server going there, identifying himself as such, and somebody coming out accepting service process. So I don't think you really even have to get back that far or go so far as remand. But If, for the sake of argument, this Court determines that, you know, there, we need more factual evidence or a record needs to be developed on this case, that would be an alternative, would be to send this back to the Circuit Court and request that there be more evidence developed with regard to this particular issue. Yes. Getting back to with regard to what must a defendant produce, that was the second issue that this Court had asked us to address, to delineate or to articulate that which is necessary, those factors that are necessary for a defendant to produce or prove in order to establish the fact that there was insufficiency of service in this case. Now, we have put forward a listing of four or five different issues. One of them was the scope, first of all, the scope of the responsibilities and the duties of the individual within the office who was identified as the managing agent or might be identified as the managing agent. The scope of the responsibilities. The scope of her, the authority that particular individual had. Does that person have it, in our case, does that person have the authority to contract, to contract on behalf of the corporation? Does that person have the authority to supervise, hire, fire, other employees on behalf of that corporation? To factors that would indicate that this particular individual had control or had authority to act on behalf of the corporation itself. Thirdly was the issue of the person's position within the company itself. In this case, as I indicated, the only thing we know about Mr. McGrath is that he was the branch manager. We went at length, and I won't repeat that here. We went into length, into great detail with regard to the actual duties that are imposed by him on a branch manager as a matter of law by SEC regulation. One of the things that I did find interesting, though, with regard to SEC regulations, is that SEC regulations specifically delineate a branch manager as being a principal. In other words, those are one of those persons who the SEC says is a principal of the corporation. And this gave me a chance to do something that I haven't done since probably college, which was to go to Webster's and to look up the definition of a principal. And here it is. A principal is a person who has controlling authority or is in a leading position, the person primarily or ultimately liable on a legal obligation. Well, that sounds a lot like what the court says we need to prove in the Carroll case.
Counsel, I assume you're making this argument to buttress your conclusion that as a matter of law, as a result of the SEC regulations and the concept that he's a branch manager, then as a matter of law, this court can hold that 801.115 and the Carroll case have been met.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. You don't have any facts here either.
No, we don't have any facts here, Your Honor, at all. And that's, again, why it becomes, I think, Judge Brown made a point of how important it is to properly allocate burden of proof in cases like this. Now, again, our argument is, well, this is an issue that was never raised or discussed at all by the Circuit Court. And assuming for the sake of argument that this court would say, well, you know, maybe there was, maybe there wasn't, looks like it might be good enough for us that this issue was in fact raised, then of course it becomes very important as to whether or not who has the burden, because there is, as this court's noted and as the Court of Appeals know, there's little to almost no evidence on this issue. Right. Other than a conclusory statement by Mr. McGrath.
Your argument on the SEC has been countered by the concept that, sure, the SEC rules govern him for securities transactions and his his position in the company, but that they don't necessarily indicate that for purposes of service in this state, he is an officer or managing agent under 801.115.
No, and they certainly wouldn't be able to do that because as they're a federal agency, and they wouldn't be able to make legislative decisions
right.
for the state.
That's right.
But with regard to what the SEC does require of a branch manager, as we laid that out in detail in our brief, they require the branch manager to review and approve customer accounts on behalf of the corporation before a corporation can do business with them. They require a branch manager to review all the sales literatures, all the advertising materials that are put out by the company or by the registered reps or the people that are under his supervision. In other words, there are duties and factors that would, if looked at properly, could be interpreted to be those duties or responsibilities that make him a controlling or a supervisory agent.
And they may not be. That there may, be a man, he may have a portfolio and account duties, but that he doesn't really manage the office and that there's a supervisor above him who is in charge of the office generally, in charge of him specifically, et cetera. Right?
Well,
can you have more than one managing agent in an office?
Well, I have to know a little bit about this because I spent 20 years as a compliance officer for a broker-dealer. No, there's one managing agent for the client for the particular office. There has to be at least one. Because this is a heavily...
agent in the office.
Yes, a branch manager. Because of the fact that this is a heavily regulated industry, as we've sort of alluded to in our brief, because it's such a heavily regulated enterprise, it's regulated by the National Association of Security Dealers. It's regulated by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mm-hmm. It's regulated by the State of Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. And there has to be somebody who is accountable. There are certain procedures, there are certain requirements, there are certain records that must be kept by each branch office. And each of the persons under his supervision are required to have their accounts reviewed, their activities reviewed by him on a daily basis. And so, excuse me, in answer to your question, there's one person in charge for each branch. Above each branch is a regional, you know, in my experience, is a regional manager who is responsible for each of the branch managers. But there has to be somebody on site responsible.
Right. As a manager for SEC. But there could be somebody within that office that has management capacities for buying goods, hiring and firing personnel, et cetera.
That would be the branch manager.
Well, it might not be. I might have a vice president in charge of that office. And there might be a branch manager, too. Is there anything in the SEC that stops me from doing that?
Well, the SEC requires that there be on file a name of a branch office manager responsible for supervising each of the individuals in the office, each one of the individuals in the office. That's the branch manager.
Okay.
So... now, does he consult with other people? Does he consult with the regional, you know, if somebody comes and says, well, you know, I want to be a broker in your firm, is there somebody else he's got to talk to? Sure, there's other people he's got to talk to. But if the branch manager, in my experience, if the branch manager says, no, I'm not hiring this person, he doesn't get hired.
But the argument here is that regardless of what you call the person, that let's say the registered agent, service had to be on the registered agent, and that's the argument opposing counsel makes.
Well, I don't think it has to be on the registration.
I'm saying I understand it.
Sure.
But
right. And what we're arguing is essentially as a managing agent, that the 801.115 basically permits a service to be made at the corporate office upon a managing agent of that particular branch office. That's what we're arguing, and that's what we're saying. So, lastly, I'll make this very quickly, is this issue of fraud and issue preclusion that was yet another issue that this Court had requested that we address. And what we had done, obviously, in response, and it's our argument that's, that this was raised for the first time, this issue of Mr. McGrath's status was an issue that was raised for the first time at the Court of Appeals. We, in turn, petitioned the Court of Appeals to amend the record and say, well, look, we don't think you ought to be listening to this issue any in the first instance, but if you're going to listen to it, at least let us amend the record and let us put in the evidence with regard to Mr. McGrath's fraudulent statement. 806.07 sub 1 sub C basically says that a party at any time within 1 year after the conclusion of or the entry of a court order has the ability or has the right to come back into court and to petition that court and to argue to that court that that particular order was based on fraud. Now, the question that I have or the question that we have raised is that if you have a situation where there is an issue which has not been considered by the circuit court, and a factual issue which then goes and is resolved by the Court of Appeals, how can that statute be given any effect? Because the practical reality is, or not the practical, the legal fact is that a Court of Appeals, having once made a determination with regard to this factual issue, the decision becomes res judicata, and the trial court has no ability at all to come back and review a decision or to overturn a decision of a Court of Appeals.
So did you ask the Court of Appeals when this issue developed and you found this other affidavit to stay the proceedings and remand it back to the trial court for a factual finding?
Yes, we did.
And
we filed a motion.
And they refused to do that?
We filed a motion for reconsideration after the order had been issued. We had initially filed a motion to either strike that portion of the brief or alternatively to amend the record to allow the introduction of this particular affidavit.
Yeah, but you were asking to amend it at the Court of Appeals level, yet factual findings are the business of the trial court, aren't they?
Right, and that's the argument. I mean, that this
my
was a
question
factual.
My question to you was, did you ask the Court of Appeals, when this issue came up, to stay the proceeding at the Court of Appeals and remand the matter to the trial court for factual findings to determine whether in fact, there was a managing agent or officer or director in the office where you had process served?
Yes, we did.
You did, okay.
We did that on a motion for reconsideration is what we did.
But that was after the Court of Appeals made its decision then?
After the Court of Appeals made a decision, we filed a motion requesting that the Court of Appeals amend its decision to remand the case back to the circuit court for determination of the issue as you had indicated.
Was there some reason that you didn't do it prior to the Court of Appeals decision?
Well, we had, as I said before, what we did is we filed a motion to strike those portions of the briefs. We filed a motion to amend the record, and a decision came back. Now, we're not going to strike and we're not going to amend the record.
You can't
point.
Amend the record at the Court of Appeals was something that was never in the trial court, right? I mean, I don't know of any provision for doing that, do you?
Well, I guess that touches on the difficulty of this case of trying or litigating new issues of fact for the first time at the level of the Court of Appeals. I mean, it really goes to the heart of this question. And this Court has said on numerous occasions, you can't do that. You know, Court of Appeals are not designed, they're not set up to determine or make determinations of issues of fact.
Right.
They're limited to the record which is in front of them and to arguments which have been presented to the circuit court.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Michael H. Shulman, representing First Union Securities.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Shulman. I'm here on behalf of First Union Securities. The first thing I want to just address very quickly is Justice Wilcox's question about the registered agent. I want to make sure that that's crystal clear from our presentation. It is not required that the registered agent be actually served, but it is an opportunity. That is an alternative that was available here. First Union had a registered agent at all times. That agent could have been served and, in fact, was not served. Now, that segues into a whole rafter of other issues that relate to the burden of proof. It is our position that the burden of proof here is on the plaintiff to establish, in fact, even when there is a motion to vacate a default judgment, that all of the procedures and the requirements of service were adhered to. First and foremost, because this Court has repeatedly said how important that is. Unless you get proper jurisdiction, in fact, you don't have a case that can go forward. You have and end up with what has happened here, a judgment that is void, a judgment that, in fact, has been vacated. The case law is a little bit confusing. You have the Emery case, which does make a conclusion, which does reach a very brief, without a lot of analysis, statement that, in fact, the burden of proof is different when a party is moving to vacate a default judgment than when a party is moving to dismiss for lack of proper service. That court, of course, relies on West. And if you read West, as I have several times, you're hard-pressed to find, in fact, where a standard or a rule of law or anything that the court in Emory really relied on can be found. I think the best that one could say is in the West case, the parties who were seeking to vacate the judgment of divorce actually made all kinds of affidavits and provided that testimony through affidavits, which the West court found was credible. And that's the quote that's, in fact, in the Emery case. We find these affidavits credible, and they were the moving party. However, there's no statement in West that's clear, that's unequivocal, that that's the standard.
Counsel, maybe I'm missing something. I understand that the motion to vacate default judgment was under 80607. And unless my recollection is faulty, my understanding of 80607 is that if the party who is seeking to reopen a case has to meet the criteria that are established in 80607. Would you disagree with that statement?
No, with criteria, yes, but in terms of the burden of persuasion or the burden of proof, I think that's not clear under that section at all. There are factors which have to be raised. Initially, a party must go forward and say, I am here to vacate this judgment because it was procured, is void, the judgment is void, because it was procured with insufficient service of process. And I think this case...
And that gets to the heart of my question. I think you just answered it, but not necessarily the way you might want to answer it. It seems to me that the party bringing the motion has to come in and say, look, this default shouldn't have been held against me, and here's why. And part of doing that is showing that the judgment was void, which puts the burden initially on you. Once you get there, then you've got the cases that indicate that issues of jurisdiction fall on the party who's defending the jurisdiction. But you still have to meet that initial burden, correct?
You certainly have the burden of going forward. There's no question. This couldn't happen unless we go to the court and we say, Your Honor, we think there's been a grave injustice here. There was a judgment which is void because of lack of sufficient service. And in this...
You would not disagree that the trial court's ruling in this case, based on waiver, it's already been conceded by opposing counsel, that was an error, correct?
Oh, absolutely.
So then why doesn't that get us back to the trial court to make the determinations on the underlying facts and issues here about whether or not, one, you've met your burden of going forward and bringing an 80607 motion, and two, whether or not you have sufficient service. Why shouldn't this all go back to forget the Court of Appeals, why doesn't it go back to the trial court and let the trial court sort this out?
Precisely because in this case it shows, number one, why the burden should actually be on the plaintiff. What happened here? There was, in fact, a motion for default filed on November 12, 2002, exactly the same day the court signs the order. Counsel for Mr. Richards comes with an affidavit which says, in fact, we have served the registered agent, which was false. They had not served the registered agent. That fact isn't in dispute. In addition, the attached to that is the check-the-box affidavit of the process server, which doesn't indicate that the registered agent was served. Right off the bat, the trial court had a contradiction. Had the trial court looked at the process server affidavit and looked at counsel's affidavit, would have said, wait a minute, These two things couldn't have happened, not together, unless there had been two attempts to serve. But there was only one.
Factual issue, correct?
That's, well, it's clear.
Which goes right to the heart of my question. Why not send it back to the trial court and let them sort it out?
Because, in fact, there was no evidence, both at the time for the default hearing or even later in when the hearing was on the motion to vacate occurred, when First Union came in with two affidavits saying, first of all, and I think there's a very narrow ground on which this court can decide this case without remand and without even reaching the question of managing an agent, and that is the question of Kim Wisniewski being the person apparently in charge of the office. The initial focus, we had both focus on our brief, but the initial focus is, wait a minute, regardless of whether this is the office of the officer, director, or managing agent, this particular service was not on the person who was apparently in charge of the office. And the affidavits by the process server are totally deficient in that regard. In the first check-the-box affidavit, they say we serve corporate service. We serve on the office of the corporation of the person apparently in charge of the office. They don't even mention managing director. There's no question about it. So they don't, it's not even clear that they're at the right office. And second of all, when Mr. Mansky puts in his second affidavit, he says, I always serve it on someone who's authorized. He doesn't say whether it's because of the objective test, is it officer, director, or managing agent, or because that person's apparently in charge of the office. The evidence was deficient on both grounds. Ms. Wisniewski's affidavit alone saying, I'm not in charge of the office, and she did explain what her duties were. She did, briefly albeit, said, I'm in charge of record keeping in the back office. I am not in charge of the office, and I never told anyone I was in charge of the office. This case can be completed on that grounds alone. There simply isn't any reason even to get to managing director, because the managing director issue is a secondary issue here. So there's no reason to remand this case. The evidence isn't going to get better from Mr. Mansky's affidavits, the check-the-box affidavit, or his affidavit which he submits weeks later in preparation for the argument. It isn't going to get any better than that. He doesn't remember, obviously, what he did and what he said. He simply says, every time I go to the office, I always ask, I only serve on an authorized person. Well,
isn't the issue here arguably a little bit different in the sense that, and I understand there's a motion to strike, and I'm not quite sure what we're going to do with this, but you have at least an argument that the branch manager was arguably also an officer of the corporation. And isn't that a fact issue that should be dealt with at the trial court? In other words, if this is an officer, and I know your argument is that it's not, and that's what the affidavit said, but if in fact the person is an officer of the corporation, then arguably service was proper and there's no grounds to reopen the default.
Even if he were an officer, Justice Butler, he was never served. He was never served. It was Ms. Wisniewski, the person apparently in charge of the office. If she is not subjectively that person, and there is absolutely no evidence in the trial court record that she was, it doesn't have to be remanded for a fact-finding on that basis. There are the two tests. Did you serve an officer, director, managing agent? Clearly, that didn't happen here. It's undisputed. Did you serve the register agent? Clearly, undisputed that that did not happen. So the question is, did you serve the person apparently in charge? She puts in an affidavit at the trial level before the trial court, says, I am not in charge of the office. I'm in charge of filling out forms and making sure forms are directly done correctly. Overcomes any presumption that the process server did it right. Then, on the other hand, we compare what do we have in this record from the process server that says, I served someone apparently in charge of the office. There's nothing. There's nothing. There's only a statement, I always do it, I always serve a person authorized. So you would go back in factual matter, what would you learn at a trial on that? You would have Ms. Wisniewski essentially, I agree, could elaborate on what she does, could elaborate on the fact that she's not apparently in charge of the office. And the process server now, these years later, is going to say, I stand on my check the box. You know, it's a corporate office, served on a corporate officer or the person apparently in charge, without any facts, without any discussion of how he met her, what she said. Even in his expanded affidavit, he makes no mention of what she said to him or what anyone else in the office said. This doesn't fall under the Horrigan case where someone comes into the process server, says, I was told that this was the right person. She came out. I gave her. There was no hiding the ball. This was simply a simple case where the court should have said, we're not, there was no proper service here because objectively there wasn't the service on the director, officer, or managing agent, or anyone apparently in charge. Now, as to the other question that the court's interested in, and that is, what is a managing agent? And I believe that even on the managing agent issue, you would not have to remand this case. First of all, officer, director, managing agent are mentioned by the statute in parallel. So managing agent is a position that is somewhat thought to be comparable to officer, director, and managing agent. In addition, that becomes much more of an objective standard. Why? Corporate officers are designated by the corporation to be the officer. That's not a matter of subjectivity. Either you are or you're not.
Well, is he senior vice president? What can't we tell from this record?
But you can tell from the record if you take that fugitive affidavit into the record, Your Honor, which has been excluded, is that he has a title. And as you are a vice president in the bank, it is different than being the vice president of the bank. Mr. McGrath is a branch manager of there are multiple branches of Wachovia Securities all over the country. If one were to assume that he was a managing agent who was in control of the corporation's policies, procedures, or its general business, it would be the same as going to a grocery store or going to a Walgreens and asking for the Walgreens branch manager. There is a branch manager in every Walgreens, I'm sure. The branch manager has specific duties. Some of them are probably regulations of the FDA or other bodies saying that you have to keep certain aisles clean, you have to deal with customers, you have to supervise the pharmacists. I don't think the court is prepared to make a statement that you can serve the manager of the Pick and Save food store, or you can serve the manager of the Walgreens, and they are the managing agent of the corporation.
But would he be in charge? Your opposing counsel argued that, based on his experience and just making a statement here, as far as you look at the duties, and if one of the duties was to handle or accept or scrutinize or look over the accounts. Now, each one of these brokerage firms, I mean, I understand your argument, I think, is he was in this so-called fugitive affidavit. I think he was a vice president, but probably Wachovia or many of these security companies have 1,000 vice presidents. I mean, that's one way of... It's a nice title.
It's certainly honorific. That's correct.
But your argument is that it, as far as the corporate management, that's where you have to look at. It isn't
yes.
Just, okay.
Yes. And I think if you look at the previous statute, which listed vice president, president, if you look at 269, the predecessor to 801.11.5, it has a variety of people there. And the legislature honed it down, compressed it to three, officer, director, and managing agent. And what I was saying earlier is that the officer and the director, those are clearly objective standards.
Well, how objective? How do I know whether it's an officer, it's a real vice president, or a fake vice president?
I would call it honorific, Your Honor.
You call it honorific, I can talk. But the truth of the matter is, what you're saying is that it's not really an officer at all. Now, you say it's so objective. How do I know? I know a lot of vice presidents. How do I know Well, in fact, I know a lot of presidents, and I'm not sure that they're a president of a local bank that's a branch bank of a statewide bank, and he's president of this local. Is he an officer of the bank or not?
Well, this court has said repeatedly is don't take a chance because we have...
Never mind. I'm taking a risk. I'm not risk averse. I'm taking the risk. I want to know if it's so objective, how do I know if the local M&I president is an officer or is a fake honorific?
Well, first of all, in these days and ages, you can go to the Internet and pull up the website of Wachovia.
You show him as a president.
Well, they're going to show you very clearly who the officers of the corporation are. They're not going to list Ron McGrath and every branch manager in Iowa, in Illinois, and all over the country as officers of the corporation. I think that's pretty understood. I think you can ask. When you go to the branch manager, you can say, "Is Mr. McGrath here?" And if he comes out and you say, "Mr. McGrath, are you an officer of this company?" You can rely one way or another on that. If he says, "No, I have a title, but I'm not an officer. I'm not elected by the board of directors or appointed by the president of this corporation."
Well, then your standard is we have to interpret this statute to mean officer or director is appointed by the corporation and by the board of directors of the corporation. Is that the point? As an officer?
Yes. I think the point of the statute is to have people who have authority and control of the general business operations of the company.
Who appointed him branch manager?
He would have been appointed branch manager by, this isn't in the record, but by the regional manager. Again,
who appointed the regional manager?
The regional manager would be appointed by a national sales manager of some sort.
Who appoints him? Does anybody like get back to an officer of the corporation?
Who appointed them? It could. It might not.
Or the board of directors.
I would be very surprised. Again, there's nothing in this record, but I would be very surprised if the board of directors of any of these corporations would be involved with appointing a branch manager. Oh. That's generally not something at that level.
So you'd say an officer or director is appointed by the board of directors. An officer and director and branch and managing.
What
manager is appointed by the board of directors, otherwise they're honorific.
What I'm saying is this. The statute talks about officers and directors. We know that those are objectively discernible positions.
Well, you've objectively defined them as they have to be appointed by the board of directors.
Well, the shareholders elect the directors, and then the directors would select a president who would then, in conjunction with the directors, take officers. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is I think these are intended to be real titles. These are because of what the reason is, who does the statute want to cover and include in serving process? Because process is a very important constitutional right, which the court has said has to be done properly and carefully, and has all kinds of issues to it, including finality. One should not ignore the fact that these cases, in fact, don't favor finality the way that we're handling this. This, in fact, spawns a whole series of other litigation. The whole fact that the way this was done at the trial court, without apparently any questions asked, counsel for Mr. Richards, it's clear in the record by the affidavits, had communications both with First Union and with counsel for First Union, both inside and outside counsel, before he went for his motion to default. There was apparently no conversation between the court and counsel for Mr. Richards, because otherwise you would have thought that he would have said, wait a minute, if you know who the counsel is,
isn't it counsel's obligation for First Union to talk to the court and the court not?
Absolutely.
And they have X number of days for answering. It was extended. There was communication. A warning was given. We're going to continue with court. I mean, the trial court doesn't have to go out and say, who are you and where are you? The trial court should just... There's no answer filed. There's an affidavit stating there's no answer filed. That ought to be good enough for the trial court to enter default.
I would disagree in this case because I think the affidavits were conflicting on their face. There was evidence right in front of the judge that, in fact, the affidavit of counsel said the registered agent had been served. If the trial judge is convinced that that's correct, that, in fact, gives the trial judge more confidence. Okay, they actually served the registered agent. We don't have to worry about officer, director, or managing agent. The court doesn't have to worry about whether someone apparently in charge of the office was filed. We know it was done with a registered agent. So if that's false, if that's not correct, and it would have been obvious to the court had they looked at the affidavit of the process server that it wasn't correct, that those were in conflict. Therefore, questions would have arisen.
Under any condition, the trial court erred.
I'm sorry?
Under any conditions, the trial court erred.
Yes, we believe the trial court erred.
And so does your opponent, because there was no waiver here.
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial court on its face has a problem.
Well, I don't know if I would go that far. I do think, however, the trial court recognized, and I would agree that his one-sentence decision was ambiguous. But he does.
No, it wasn't ambiguous. You lost.
It was ambiguous in this regard, Your Honor. It was ambiguous in this regard. And, you know, lawyers pull out whatever they can, slender threads.
You should do that because you need every slender thread.
Counselor, before you go on with slender threads, I have a different question for you. Is Mr. McGrath an agent of the corporation?
Of course.
If he holds himself out as an officer or managing agent, does he then have apparent authority to receive service or process?
I think the Merritt case, by analogy, helps us in that regard, and that is what this court said in 2005, that under a different section, albeit of the service rules, service of process rules, that in fact you have to actually have that authority. It has to be expressed. You don't get that authority by apparent authority. I would argue in the same way here. Mr. McGrath, and again, remember, Mr. McGrath was never served with any piece of paper at any time, and Mr. McGrath was not asked. The process server didn't come back two or three times and say, I'm trying to find this Mr. McGrath. He never represented me.
I know all that. I just have a different concern.
I think that the question is, I think, answered in the Merritt case, because there this court found that under different rules for personal service of a person, that you couldn't serve an agent, even if the agent thought he was.
Yeah, but people don't act by agents. My question goes to a corporation who can only be served by an agent, because corporation isn't really anything but a legal concept.
Right.
And so do you know of any case that deals with a corporation, either in our state or otherwise, where someone holds themselves out as either an officer or a managing agent of that corporation, and by that holding out subjects the corporation to service of process through him?
I know of no case, but I would think, Your Honor, that the nature of the objective versus the subjective. This court has talked about the difference between officer, director, or managing agent. These are things that are objectively discernible, as opposed to the subjective, apparently in charge of the office. I would think that it's pretty clear that they're not allowing someone who holds themselves out, who doesn't have authority, who's not an officer, to stand up to the world and say, I will take these service, even if they are, in fact, an employee. I think because this would spawn additional litigation, which would not increase the finality, the idea that these cases are supposed to be final and that the courts have to do the scrutiny to make them final to avoid the void judgments and the constitutional infirmities.
Counsel, how do you define managing agent? We know we've talked about officers and directors. I want to set those aside.
It is apparently a term that has some history to it. In the Carroll case, they talk about, there are two other cases in Wisconsin that talk about a managing agent as someone who has general overall supervisory control of the affairs of the company. of the corporation. I don't think it's a term, quite frankly, that is used actively anymore in the corporate world. I think, in fact, it's a little bit outdated. The legislature kept that term. What we learned from Carroll, however, based on the facts there, the superintendent, and that was also a word that used to be used, superintendent, is no longer used. It's been taken out of the statute. But the person in charge of the plant, who was hiring and firing, who was charged of all of the activities of that particular plant, was not considered a managing agent.
What's your definition of a managing agent?
A managing agent is going to be someone like, again, in parallel, a corporate officer or a corporate director who has overall supervisory responsibilities for the business of the company, who's involved in policy making for the company, who's
we
involved...
We also have cases that talk about not... that bring it home a little closer, that is, a little closer to home, not just of the company, but of what would be like a branch office here. I mean, we have cases that stand, that would extend it from a home office to a more remote location. The person who's in charge, who has discretion to make decisions.
Well, that's certainly not what Carroll does in terms of its definitions, because the plant superintendent, the manager of that facility, is very comparable to a branch manager in the securities world. In fact, I think it's very clear from the Carroll case that that person had more authority, more control, was involved, in fact, in more decision-making about that part of the business than anything in the record reflects here.
So that's your definition of a managing agent, someone who has authority to make decisions, and I'm going to throw in just for the home office.
For making policies and decisions for the company as a whole or for some significant portion. If you said to me, for example, there's a subsidiary of a company and they call the managing agent, they use that title as the managing agent to run a subsidiary of Miller Brewing in Sydney, Australia, they very well might have that. And that's why we resisted coming up with a blanket rule that's going to apply in every situation. This is the kind of situation we know where it isn't, and it's not Mr. McGrath, but it's more difficult for us to tell you exactly what it is in every situation. But again, I think the fact that the statute reflects, I believe, a position of significant policymaking and power, officer, director, and managing agent. I think those being in tandem is very, very important. And in fact, the very next sentence in the statute relates, it says, and this officer. Now, the 801.11.5a isn't also that clear, but I think if you read that, it suggests actually that they're talking about the status of officer and that they're using the managing agent as another way of describing officer. And I think historically there is some support for that, even in the cases where the definition was lumped together with officer, director, president, vice president, cashier, and so on.
Counselor, in an 80607 motion, can new factual information be provided to an appellate court?
I don't believe so.
Is an 80607 motion an appropriate motion to bring at the appellate level, or is it just a motion for the trial court level?
I believe it's just a trial court motion. That's right.
Looking at 80607 and the burden of persuasion, of course, 80607 has this laundry list of things. And it's your maintaining that the burden of persuasion is on the plaintiff here.
Yes.
So 80607.1 deals with mistake, inadvertent surprise, or excusable neglect, which we see a lot of on the circuit court. Who has the burden of persuasion with regard to that? Plaintiff or person seeking to open the default judgment or the person who obtained the default judgment or judgment?
I believe there are different standards when you get to Section D, which is the judgment is void. And that is because it is so important to have the service of process constitutionally correct. And I think the other A, B, and C have a different aspect to them. Because
it's your position that, and if I may just push you on this a bit, A, B, C, E, F, G, and H would all have the person wishing to open the default judgment to have the burden of persuasion, and only D of that alphabet soup is your opponent's?
I am not sure I could give you such a precise answer. What I will tell you is 806.07D certainly has the burden of persuasion and proof on the part of the plaintiff. Once, as I think Justice Butler pointed out to me quite correctly, obviously there is a going forward. You can't expect the other side to know your argument or know that there's even a problem until you've made the motion. But once you've made the motion and you've argued that, then it seems to me that the burden shifts because now you are protecting a judgment. And in this case, again, I've said it once, I'll say it again, in this case shows how important that is, because these kinds of default judgments are obtained on the flimsiest of records without any questions being asked and without maybe any questions needing to be asked. Perhaps through Justice Abramson's question, she's very right that the trial court need not ask any questions. But just precisely because of that, when it is raised that the process of service was not done constitutionally, not done as precisely as this court has repeatedly said, then the burden shifts to the party defending that judgment. Now, I would like to say just in conclusion to that, that even if the burden of proof is on the defense in this case, we believe it is more than adequately, we have established it. First, because of the Wisniewski claim, that is, you don't have to reach the whole question of the managing agent. That issue need not be reached here, and the case can certainly be affirmed. But even if you reach that level, it's clear that Mr. McGrath's affidavit was sufficient to put on the court on notice and to put the other side on notice that he was not the managing agent, he did not have that title, and that he did not have the responsibilities, and he even stated because there were no managing agents in Wisconsin.
Is that Solomon?
Yes, ma'am.
Your red light's been on for a while.
Thank you.
If you had the burden of proof, would it be by clear and convincing evidence?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Bolt, you have a few minutes in rebuttal.
Oh, I'd like to pick up on Justice Bradley's question a little bit with regard to the burden of proof. We've been looking at the statute. Let me direct your attention to the actual case, Emery versus Emery. This is what this Court said in that case. The Circuit Court in the instant case properly placed the burden on Mr. Emery, who is the defendant seeking to vacate the judgment, who sought to vacate the judgment to produce credible evidence to show that Ms. Emery did not exercise reasonable diligence in her attempt to personally serve him. The case relied on by Mr. Emery's counsel, which, by the way, is the same case that Mr. Shalman's relying on, Danielson versus Brody, is distinguishable in that it involved a motion to dismiss a complaint for want of personal jurisdiction. In the instant case, we are dealing with a motion to vacate a judgment, and the standard described in West applies. That's what this Court said in Emery. Now, in the West case, the Court didn't come right out and say, you know, the defendant's got the burden of proof to put on a motion to vacate. But what it did say in the very first sentence of the opinion is that the issue or the test for this motion is whether or not there was sufficient credible evidence introduced to prove that service was not effectuated or was insufficient for some reason. In other words, the burden is on the person challenging the jurisdiction to prove that it was insufficient. Now, I think it's important. I think the distinction makes all the sense in the world, because basically what we said in our brief is in First Union's legal world, according to them, they can come in years hence and dispute the jurisdiction, and according to them, the burden then is on the plaintiff 20 years hence to come forward and to prove that personal jurisdiction was in effect, was effectuated properly. That just doesn't make any sense. I mean, at some point you've got to draw a line. There has to be an end to litigation. And that's why I think the burden is shifted, because there's policy in the law that says that at some point litigation has to end. There has to be finality to these judgments. And so if you want to come in and you want to argue that jurisdiction was, that this case is void for lack of jurisdiction, fine, do it. But you got the burden of proof under those circumstances.
Well, let me ask you this. Here's what's troubling me with the case. Both parties have sat here and argued that we should reach the merits of this case and decide it here. As to who's got the appropriate burden, apply it, and here's your answer, and go home. And yet both parties have agreed that the trial court's decision was erroneous as a matter of law in applying the waiver standard. I think both parties would agree that the trial court therefore never appropriately applied the burden in this case. And I think both parties have sat here and they've argued a difference of what the facts mean. So I guess my question once again, and maybe I'm just stuck on it, is that given the factual issues that both parties are arguing, and the fact that the trial court never reached those facts, the trial court never appropriately applied the burden, and the trial court made its decision on an erroneous ruling as a matter of law, why isn't it appropriate for this court to set forth the appropriate burden and then send it back to the trial court to apply it?
I guess my response to that would be this, is how many, and for lack of a better term, how many kicks of the cat does a movement get in this case? You've made your motion, you've brought your evidence, turns out that you didn't meet your burden, now you're going to come back and you're going to bring the motion again. I mean,
the opposing counsel is making the same argument about you.
Right. So we don't have the burden. I think it's very clear. We didn't have the burden in this case. And in order to get to the conclusion that Mr. Shulman would advocate, you're going to have to overturn Emory. I don't see any other way around it. I mean, Emory is very clear as to who has the burden under these circumstances. And there's really no compelling reason. They haven't offered any compelling reason for doing it. There's no change in circumstances of law or anything of that nature. Just one more point I want to get on. Again, it was a point brought up by Justice Bradley. Talking about whether or not, you know, is it appropriate or can you serve a branch office? Is it only appropriate to serve a home office? And again, the leading case on this is the Carroll case, and let me read from that one, just briefly from page 494. The superintendent, as appears in 262, which again was a predecessor to 801, has a mean corresponding to that of managing agent referred to therein. Both terms relate to a person possessing and exercising the right of general control, authority, judgment, and discretion over the business affairs of the corporation, and here's the key line, either on an overall basis, the home office, or part basis, i.e., everywhere or in a particular branch or district. So what the Carroll case is saying is that, you know, and it would make, for all intents and purposes, it would make service on a national or an out-of-state corporation impossible. The only way that you'd be able to serve them would be on a registered agent. But that's not what Carroll says. Carroll says, you know, there's got to be somebody in control of these branch offices. There's got to be somebody running the show at these branch offices who is in a position of enough responsibility that we can comfortably rely on that person to transmit the summons or complaint to the proper legal department or the proper department for processing. And in this case, that's exactly what happened. There's no argument that they didn't receive it. It was given to this particular office, Ms. Wisniewski. It was forwarded on to opposing counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Bolt, and thank you, Mr. Shulman, for your very interesting arguments on who to serve. You'd think after all the years we've been in business of serving and all these statutes are of long standing that we'd have this down pat. And you both indicate maybe we do, maybe we don't. So that concludes our argument 04AP 1877, Riches versus First Union Securities. The court will be in recess until 1:30 when we'll hear our last case in the March oral arguments. The students should remain here, and Justice Bradley will be out momentarily to talk with them. We are in recess.